Bandwidth for this podcast is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of TWIP is brought to you by the new voice-activated sync featuring hands-free calling, music, and podcast search, along with turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And enter to win a free Nano or Zune. Just send a tweet with the hashtag SyncMyRidePodcast.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twip.
This week on TWIP, social media sites stripping metadata, Saturday Night Live goes DSLR, and special guest commercial shooter Joey L. All that and more on episode number 116 of This Week in Photography. And welcome back to another exciting episode of This Week in Photography. I am your host, Frederick Van Johnson. Today on the show today, we got some not-so-new faces and a brand-new face. First up is Mr. Steve Simon. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Fred. You're saying I'm an extremely old face? Is that what I heard?
I didn't have the word extremely in there. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I just,
okay.
I said right. Not so new. You could be slightly, and it depends on your perception of old anyway. You know, okay. You're about the same age as me. So.
Well, I had work done, but I guess I didn't get my money's worth. But carry on. Continue.
I'm not even going to go down that road. And also coming from down south, of me at least, is Mr. Ron Brinkman. Hey, Ron.
Hello. How are we doing today?
We are doing great. And a very special guest is joining us on the show. Someone who has been involved in This Week in Photography for a while now, but kind of behind the scenes. We've got Mr. Bruce Clark joining us. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
It's going great. Hey, so, Bruce, for the folks that... Oh, you are on video. We do have you. Awesome.
Yeah, I got it working, yes. I switched over to my laptop from my external display. I don't know what was going on there if my cinema display wasn't working, so...
All right. And it looks like in Canada they may have bad bandwidth because we're getting about a frame a second from you, and your audio is a little bit choppy, but we're going to press
on. Welcome to where I live.
All right. So, tell the folks a little bit about yourself, Bruce, before we jump in.
Well, I'm up in Edmonton, which is Steve's old stomping grounds.
Yes, it is.
So, Steve, I have not met your mother, but you're welcome to come by anytime and hang out.
Okay, she's
the show.
On her way over now, I think, with some cookies.
Oh, excellent, perfect. So, so I'm up here in Edmonton, Alberta, where it's actually beautiful out today. We're having unseasonably warm weather up here in Edmonton right now, so it's quite nice. And I'm primarily an event and wedding photographer up here in the city. And I've been helping out along with Tom Newman, who does the Fog View podcast, doing the show notes for TWIP probably since about show, I'd have to look back and see when I started doing them, but I'd say probably around show 70, 75, somewhere in that neighborhood. So, and then I also do the show notes for Scott Bourne on Photo Focus. So I keep pretty busy hanging on your guys' every words every week. So.
You're getting all the uhs and ands and buts and everything in there, right?
You bet, yep.
Well, thank you for that. And if any of you TWIP listeners out there have gone to twiplog.com and looked at the very detailed transcripts of every word we say, Bruce isn't kidding. Every word we say, pretty much, they transcribe it and put it down so that you can read along or listen or however you want to consume the show. So,
but you mean all of this stuff has been on the record?
Everything is on the record.
Oh, my God.
It's almost like having a court stenographer in the room, you know, chatting away or typing away.
Retract certain statements, please.
Yeah. No, it's too late. Once you say it, it's on the air. Quick nod to our sponsors, Squarespace and Ford. These are the folks that make this show possible, so thank you to you guys. I wanted to mention the new Squarespace iPhone app. So Squarespace has launched a new app for you to stick on your iPhone to manage your Squarespace blog or site. And like I said before at the top of the show, using Squarespace is just a really quick and easy way to build and host and manage your website. They've got that easy UI for creating and managing your web presence, and they're optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. Lots of design templates to choose from that are customizable to fit your needs. If you want to get your free trial, head over to squarespace.com/twip. No credit card needed, just to build your website. And then if you decide that you'd like to stick with them, enter the code TWIP when you check out to get 10% off. And also, as I mentioned, this show is also sponsored by Ford, and the new Sync in your Ford Lincoln Mercury or Lincoln and Mercury vehicles. What it does is it listens to your voice, so without using your hands, you can make calls on your mobile phone, find and play music and podcasts, of course, get turn-by-turn navigation, and access real-time traffic and weather, all hands-free from Sync. If you'd like to get more details on Sync, head over to SyncMyRidePodcast.com and enter to win a free Nano or Zune by sending a tweet with the hashtag SyncMyRidePodcast. All right, let's jump into the news, guys. First off, we've got Nikon USA launching a new video contest with a $100,000 prize. Steve, I think you probably already entered this. Are you eligible to enter this since you're sponsored by Nikon and all that?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm eligible to answer it, but certainly looks pretty exciting, and I think it'll probably give some people with video capabilities on their DSLR the kick to maybe try something a little more comprehensive and do a little video. I don't know if you guys looked, but I looked at the judges' videos, and they're quite fun to watch. The judges are Chase Jarvis, who I know we've had on the show.
Yeah.
Rain Wilson from The Office. I love that guy. He's hilarious. His video is great. Mm-hmm. And Justine Azarek. Did I pronounce that?
Oh, Justine. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's really all kind of a fun kind of a deal. But let's face it, that $100,000 prize is more than fun. And
all right, Steve,
I'm sure.
Steve, you're jumping to the end, though. So we know who the judges are. We know what the prize is. But what's the contest? Tell them. what's the contest about? What do they have to do to be judged by iJustine, The Office Guy, and Chase?
Yeah, my understanding is basically to use your DSLR to create a small video. And, you know, the details are both, you know, they're on the Nikon on website. And the video, the maximum length for submitted videos sort of comes from the Twitter universe, 140 seconds. And, of course, all three judges are big players on Twitter as well. So it's got to be short, 140 seconds, which is, if my math is correctly, a little over 2 minutes. And it'll be fun to see what comes from this. But certainly, I think it will just kind of push people into playing with this a little bit more seriously. What do you guys think?
Yeah. What do you think, Ron? I know you're all about video and talking about it on This Week in Photography. Ron, what do you think about this contest?
This is a not insignificant chunk of change to be giving away. To the point where you've got to wonder, are people that are sort of semi-pro going to get involved in this? I mean, this is, you know, that's enough money that it would be worth putting a lot of post-production time into a video like this. And you've got to wonder, the level of work you're going to get may be quite high.
Yeah, and the gear to do it, I guess that's the whole point, the gear to do it isn't that expensive. So the barriers to entry are not that high, and the potential reward is $100K. Mm. Wow. Mm. Or $25K. With a D5000 kit.
A D5000 kit. And I think the D5000 kit is kind of a reminder that this really is, and I agree, Ron, I think more professional people will probably get involved just because of that big prize money. But I think, you know, by offering a D5000 as a prize, I mean, they could have offered a D300S or a D3S for that matter as a prize. And certainly, you know, with $100,000 as a first prize, I mean, they certainly could have. But I think it's aimed at more the less than professional crowd. So we'll see what transpires. We know that you can get professional results with, the entry level equipment. So it'll be fun to see what comes from it.
Yeah, and definitely also one quick note, which sort of changes the whole lens through what you, through which I'm looking at this contest, is you can use any video capable camera to shoot this video. So it doesn't have to be a Nikon camera. You could do it with your iPhone if you wanted to. And the theme is a day through your lens, and you need to submit before December 15th, 2009. Bruce, are you going to enter this?
That was going to be my question, is would I be automatically disqualified for entering with a video shot on a 5D Mark II?
No, it says any video capable camera, so you could do it with a flip if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Are they really going to give this prize away to somebody that shoots on a Canon? Would they really do that?
Hey, it's their rules.
Rules are the rules, and you got to believe that they're going to. If you read the fine print, though, it says Vince Laferre not eligible. But aside from that, I think anything's possible.
Yeah. Vince is probably cutting his video right now, I would say. So, but, you know, you never know. You're right. We're going to see some very interesting clips out of this. It's a cool contest. All right, second up in the news, Facebook and MySpace strip photo copyright data. So basically a report published by this week by the American Society of Media Photographers took a look at the terms of service for Facebook, PhotoBucket, Flickr, MySpace, YouTube, and Twitter. And basically these social media sites have reserved the right to revise their terms, but the report warns, in addition, users don't read and don't understand the terms of service of their photo copyright when they upload them to these services. So I don't know. Steve, Scott Bourne are two of the folks that pay the most attention to photo copyright and these sorts of issues. Yours because you're a professional photographer that shoots to put food on the table, and Scott because he's very, very adamant about people not stealing his work. What do you think about this?
Well, you know, whenever the ASMP talks, I think professional photographers listen. They do such great work and such great advocacy on the part of all photographers. And it's just kind of maddening and annoying to think that specifically they are stripping the metadata, including the copyright information from these files as stuff is being uploaded. Flickr is mentioned in this, but they don't talk about Flickr to the same extent, the same negative extent they do of Facebook and MySpace.
Yeah.
But it's just another reminder that, and you know, there has to be a reasonable expectation that when you post anything on the web, there's always a chance that stuff is going to be used without your permission. And if it's used by if big commercial places are kind of dumb enough to use it and they get caught, you know, they're going to have to pay the price and you're going to benefit from it. It's just another reason to, if you're serious about your work and you plan to make some money from it now and into the future, to copyright your stuff in the United States with the Copyright Office. You can do it online. You can do it in sort of a gang. You can take 1,000 images and copyright them at the same time for $35. More increasingly, I think it's going to become more important. But I just find this kind of annoying. It's like, how much can we get away with? And they do. But I'm glad to see that ASMP and organizations like it are monitoring this for all of us. And, you know, I mean, it's just another reason to sort of take note and be aware and be warned.
Yeah. Now, Bruce, from a wedding and event photographer standpoint, I would assume you're very plugged into social media, which means you're probably using Facebook and those sorts of tools to promote your work. Now, are you when you put things on Facebook, knowing now that they're able to strip your metadata and copyright data out of the image, will you still continue to use that service for promotion?
Yeah, you know, I'm not too concerned about, you know, particularly with the things like the wedding images and that type of stuff. You know, I'm not too concerned that the quality that I generally put it up on those sites, you know, isn't going to be a quality that's going to be usable from a print standpoint. So I'm not overly concerned from that end of things. You know, I'm sure to watermark my images as well. I know last week Trey brought up that he hated watermarks on images. But I think it's not only to sort of protect the image, but also from a branding perspective, you know, getting that out there. Yeah. So I'm not generally too concerned about putting it up there. I mean, if you know, you look at the situation last week with Toyota, you know, sort of getting their hand caught in the cookie jar by taking photos off of Flickr. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to happen. I think just being aware, you know, that it can happen, and there's always a chance it's going to, you know, once it's up there, it's going to get out once it's out in the wild. But generally, I'm not too overly concerned about it.
Yeah. What about
you?
I
think it's a good point about watermarking, though, because I'm surprised people would have even assumed that sort of embedded data, copyright information, you know, in EXIF or whatever would be maintained through all of these various programs that's out there. And so I kind of agree that watermarking can be ugly, especially if it's something where you really splash it across the entire image, trying to make the image useless. But I think a subtle kind of watermark on the bottom, you know, like you said, is branding as much as anything. And what it also does then is sort of help preserve that information, even if somebody, you know, sees a picture on the web and copies it to their desktop and then mails it to a friend and then somebody else gets a mailing of it. And then eventually it ends up back on the web somewhere with no history behind it. Mm-hmm. In terms of embedded data. At least if you've got a watermark on it, there's always going to be some sort of record on there. Even if it's a little tiny text sort of down at the bottom and very subtle, at least there's some sort of trail there for where it came from.
Yeah, I tend to fall on the same side with Trey on that because, you know, if you put a watermark and you make it subtle, you put it in lower right corner and there's a line there, because if you make it so obtrusive that it distracts from all the work that you put into the photo, then what's the point? If you make it so small that it's very, you know, sort of nondescript at the bottom of the image, then if somebody wants to steal the image, they're going to steal it and crop that out anyway. So
yeah, no, my point was not so much about preventing people that are actively trying to steal it so much as, like I said, this scenario where an image may float around the web for a while. And, you know, who knows? Somebody could find this image, think it's pretty cool, toss it up on Flickr, happened to click the Creative Commons license on it, and somebody else coming along would be like, well, this looks like somebody took this photo and has put it out to the public so I can use it. And by having, you know, a very small, subtle watermark on there, you can at least prevent that kind of a scenario from happening.
Yeah. I mean, I know there's lots of technologies out there that are designed to prevent that, you know, everything from embedding it in a Flash document that you can't right-click and save to, you know, all kinds of CSS tricks to prevent that. But in the end, you know, we all know if somebody wants your image, they're probably going to get it. You can make it a little bit harder, but if they want it and it's online, then they're probably going to get it. Then you just have to enforce it other ways, yep, your copyright.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys have all seen examples. I've encountered lots of websites where they've been even too lazy to remove the iStock, you know, photographic. You look at they've used an image on a corporate website and you see the iStock photo watermark in the background. You sort of shake your head and wonder what are these guys thinking.
Yeah, it's like, sue me please is what they're thinking. Yeah.
All right. That's the one thing guys, that and you guys just totally hit upon it. I mean, there's really nothing you can do, but ASMP report did mention that watermarking is the one thing you could do, and I think, you know, Ron is definitely right. You can't assume that your stuff is gonna, you know, is gonna stay in the metadata, but the watermark will prevail. And please don't, you know, ruin the image with a giant watermark, but something subtle is better than nothing at all.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Thanks, Steve. All right, another story in the news today. Canon, or the Canon EOS 5D, this is all according to a press release from Canon, so insert grain of salt, but the Canon EOS 5D Mark II and the 7D were used to capture the high-definition video used for the Saturday Night Live title sequence. So using off-the-shelf digital SLRs to capture media to be used in the sequence on this, you know, this very popular television program. What do you guys think about that? And Ron, sorry, this was in the news. I know you're not supposed to be going down the video rat hole, but this is really relevant. So, Ron, what do you think about it?
I think the thrust of it, the point they made was the sort of stealth mode you can be in carrying around a consumer type camera, SLR camera, versus a video camera. And, you know, they mentioned that was sort of one of the advantages of it, is that they could be shooting in locations, not have to have, I mean, you know, some of the low light capabilities were part of it, but just generally being able to carry on these cameras and look more like tourists as opposed to a production company shooting something. I think there's a lot of benefit to be gotten there.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Steve? You haven't jumped in with both feet into that whole motion world yet. You're still just doing the one click thing.
Well, no, I definitely plan on jumping in. I've been thinking about maybe what I can do with it. And now with that $100,000 prize, you know, that might just get me going even more. But in all seriousness, I think it's great. I haven't seen the Saturday Night Live entry. Have you guys? I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm assuming it looks fantastic. And there's no question. There's something to be said about going in kind of stealth and being able to do stuff, you know, rather than asking for permission and getting all these permits and so on. You'll be able to do things that you couldn't do before the capabilities of these new cameras. And when, you know, real experienced professional video people embrace them, it'll be really interesting to see what they're going to come up with. So it's exciting on all ends. But I do plan on getting in. I just haven't started yet.
Yeah, Bruce, have you incorporated a video into your wedding and event workflow yet?
I haven't gone that route yet. I've started to experiment a little bit with the video, but you know it's a whole another beast. You can't just pick up a 5D Mark II and expect, you know, the Vincent Laferre results out of the box. I think you really. There's a whole bunch of other gear you need to get into, and it's just a whole other beast in terms of editing and getting down that path. So I've started to dabble in it a little bit, but I certainly haven't incorporated it into any of the wedding or event stuff at this stage. But you know, it's something that I'm definitely interested in, and something I would like to do down the road, but not so far.
Yeah.
No, I just wanted to add, Fred. I think that you know, with cameras like the D3S and the 5D Mark II. What interests me the most is what I can do kind of like when I shoot with available light, very low profile documentary style. I'm not really interested in having a crew with me and creating something like that. I'm more interested in more kind of fly in the wall creation of real images, real stories that you can do with these cameras and seeing what you can get. Because I agree, Bruce, I mean, a lot of the stuff you do see coming out of these DSLRs are very produced situations. But I think part of what Saturday Night Live was doing was the fact that you don't need all that stuff necessarily. And I think you can do a lot without it.
Now it's time for this week's interview. This is with a photographer. I want to call him a new photographer, but he's done more than a lot of people have done in their career. So we're just going to call him a photographer. His name is Joey Lawrence, and he goes by Joey L. He's at joeyl.com. At 19, Joey L. has accomplished more than many veteran photographers have in their entire careers. So think about that for a second and let it soak or burn in. He's already one of the hottest commercial photographers in New York City, and he's only just getting started. His already impressive client list has companies like Warner Brothers Records, Forbes, NBC, the Sci-Fi Channel, Kawasaki, and the list goes on and on. Joey has agreed to come on the show to talk about his philosophy towards photography, his technique, and his successes. Joey, welcome to This Week in Photography.
That was very good. Did you practice that?
I did, like three times.
All right, yeah.
I practiced it and committed it to memory, you know. So. I'm trying to sound all, you know, NPR professional here. Come on.
Thank you. If you did a lot better, I'd be like, I don't take pictures.
I clicked the shutter. Yeah. It's cool, man. You know, this is awesome. You and I ran into each other at Photo Plus in New York.
We did.
And had a chance to chat for a bit at the Drobo booth that I was being a drone in. And
you sold me on Drobo. I'm going to get one.
You know, I had on my Drobo marketing hat. You know, I can create that reality distortion, reality feed around people.
You sold me.
That's awesome. Cool. So, you know, after we met and, you know, I was, of course, did all my due diligence to, like, dig into everything about you. But I figured, you know what, when you and I talked initially, you seemed very personable and, you know, not guarded at all. So I figured, you know, we'll just chat and dive into this thing and see where the conversation goes. So I'm curious, where did you get started in all this stuff? I mean, you're 19 years old. When did you start shooting? I mean, because you're competent and highly professional, and you blow the doors off of a lot of other people. How'd you get to where you are now?
I started out when I was really, really young. Like when I was 7, I used to make home movies with my home like Hi-8 video camera, and I would take dinosaur puppets and film them chasing me by putting them like in front of the camera and making them bigger. And then our family got a point-and-shoot camera, and I used to experiment with that. And then I took local bands from my small town in Ontario, Canada. And then my first rep was actually a music rep, and he sent me on tour with a bunch of metal bands across America when I was in high school. And then I used that to build my first commercial portfolio. But all the while, I was still doing all my own personal travel stuff. And and then slowly the music part of my book is getting smaller and the other part bigger. So that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. So, you know, you're a major force in the industry. And, you know, a lot of people may know your work from the Twilight movie. And
right.
So you did you do the poster or the entire ad campaign for that? Or how, what?
For the first movie, all the I guess all the like the advertising you see is from the shoot. But I don't know. The funny part is, like, I can tell people what I do. I can say, like, you know, like, yeah, I photographed, you know, a lot of Brahmin priests, Ethiopian tribes, and Twilight. And then they're like, oh, Twilight!
Yeah,
oh,
I know
cool,
it.
Man. That's must have changed your life. It's like, well.
Really. That's awesome. Yeah, I watched some of the video of one of the things on your blog promoting the training that you have up there, and you had a segment in the video clip of you teaching an Ethiopian guy how to do the handshake. You know, what was going on in that? What was the deal there?
Oh no, it was just it's just getting people comfortable with me. That's all.
Yeah.
It's just so I can, you know, be a better photographer.
Well, talk about that. So when you're in exotic locales, like say Ethiopia, and you've got the barriers of everything, right? Language, the way you look, you're coming in there with all this gear that they may not have seen before. How do you get them into a state of mind to allow, you know, this young kid from that they'd never seen before to take their photo, and you come away with something that's brilliant?
It's hard to do. It's a process because it starts out without taking photos at all, especially to do what I do with, you know, like studio light and all those places. You know, a lot of them have never seen that before, and it scares them. So I have to spend probably the majority of my time just building trust before any photos come out. And I think that's what makes a better portrait anyway. So I say like this, like my first hobby is travel. And my second hobby is photography. So the travel has to come first, and that's how you break down walls and everything. And then I can actually get in to take portraits, and all the interesting things that happened to me are because I was trying to take pictures anyway. So the two work hand in hand pretty good.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. So being in a location sort of, and I think it might have been Trey Ratcliffe I was talking to a while ago that was talking about how just putting yourself in a different location inspires you to do different kinds of photography and pull out photos from yourself than you would normally do. Do you feel that? So say you're traveling to someplace like Japan or something. Do you feel like you're inspired in a different way than if you're just back in New York City?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm from Ontario, Canada, so I get inspired walking out my doorway because I live in Bushwick in Brooklyn, so it's like Puerto Rico, Dominicanville. You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't think you have to travel far to get inspired or anything like that, but I think when you live somewhere for so long, you kind of miss things. You miss the obvious, so it takes a photographer from a different place to actually document those things.
Yeah.
so a lot of people could say, like, what's that movie, Slumdog Millionaire?
Uh-huh.
There's that whole argument whether Danny Boyle could have made a movie on India because he's a foreigner. But I think the argument for that is, well, yeah, he can make a really good movie because he sees things that locals miss seeing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, that is a whole other conversation in itself.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you live in the San Francisco Bay Area and never take a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge kind of thing.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I haven't even taken a picture of the Brooklyn Bridge because I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, I can see it from.
Or your mind says, you know, it's always there. I'll get to it some other time. You know.
Right. Right. Right.
So you mentioned, so in Ethiopia, you mentioned you brought studio lighting gear out there. So
yeah.
Can you take me through the process, the thought processes behind why bringing studio lighting and big soft boxes and all that stuff out there, as opposed to doing the Joe McNally thing or the David Hobby thing with small strobes?
Oh, well, like technically it's just a stylistic element. I mean, I've seen a lot of you know African tribe coffee table books. It's not the most original subject, if you want to call those people like a subject. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to do something like a little bit more personal, a little bit different approach stylistically. So all my portraits from that area I consider to be really personal, really like pose, sit down, take time. And I think that adds another element of trust to it, and you can actually see it in the photographs. But like talking technically, why I didn't bring small strobes, like a strobist setup or something like that, mm-hmm. is just because they're like not powerful enough for what I want to do. And they also look a little bit different than studio flashes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So then when you're on location, how does it work? You know, when you're in terms of being inspired and coming up with a concept for a particular shot. Do you go to the location and spend some time there and then you know, have that eureka moment, or do you have an idea of what you're going to shoot before you get there?
For like commercial shoots?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, like usually how it works, and it depends on the job as well. Like we can kind of choose a location that fits, and then I can think of all the ideas I want beforehand, but it might change when I actually get there and I think like, oh, maybe I can do this. So I think it's important to like have a good idea going in, but then still be open to change your idea.
Yeah. Well, you're an artist, right? You never know what's going to happen, and you know, you just go with it.
Yeah. Things always screw up. So you gotta be prepared. Yeah.
Yep. You know, I read some interesting things, or actually I was listening, one of the videos that I saw on your site, you were talking about just gear, and you had a philosophy towards gear, you know, whether you need good gear to take good shots, that sort of thing. What are your thoughts is for the This Week in Photography audience?
Oh, well, I think it's like this. It's like, I'm not one of these people that say like, oh no, it's 100% not the camera. Because of course, if you want to take a high resolution picture, you need a good camera. Like you need, you know, so many megapixels to make a good print. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anyone should ever be, feel like they can't take photos because they have a crappy camera. Like you got to have a starting point. So I think that, you know, good photography is never decided by the equipment. Good equipment just makes things a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So I think whatever you got, like, make sure you use it to its full potential. Because, like, I started getting paid just shooting bands with a point and shoot. So I don't think it really matters that much. But I mean, there are certain things that determines a good print or not. So
yeah.
Use your point and shoot, save your money, and then get good gear, and don't ever cheap out on gear, because once you get good stuff, then you'll never have to buy it again.
Yeah. Well, where do you fall on zoom lenses versus fixed focal length lenses?
Oh, I prefer prime lenses, but I don't really care.
It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, like I like prime lenses just because they're like sharper and like they make you move around a little more. But I mean, I've used zoom lenses too before on shoots where it's just like whatever. So yeah. I don't know. Like, don't overthink it. Just go and shoot.
Totally. So Joe, you're in a position now where gear, you know, you don't have to worry about what gear you're going to use because you pretty much have everything. Everything's accessible, right? So,
oh yeah, I'm behind the times. I don't even know what's going on anymore. There was a point where I knew all about fancy new cameras and stuff, and now I don't know nothing. I just learned about like the 7D video like a couple days ago.
Wow.
I'm like, wow, yeah, that looks pretty cool. I should probably try to use that somehow. But
That's good.
I don't know. I'm really behind the times, but I think it's relaxing because I hate talking about camera shit to other photographers. It's annoying.
Totally.
I think it
goes down the path of like what we talk about on the show a lot is it's not about the gear, right? It's more, look, for example, the physics behind light and photography, aperture, shutter speed, composition, all that stuff has not changed since photography was invented. So if you master all that stuff, then who cares what gear you're using, right?
Yeah, if you want to be a good photographer, don't read books on that stuff. You know, read books on psychology and stuff like that, because then you'll be able to get understand your subjects a lot better, and then you'll be able to take much better photographs of them.
That's interesting. So talk about that a little bit. Like, say, first of all, you know, just sort of closing off the gear side of the thing a little bit.
Yeah,
sure. Conversation. I
kind of ruined it when I said I hate talking about gear, but
now we're going to talk about gear. That's how I roll, man. You say you don't want to talk about it, we're going to talk about it. No, yeah. But say you're going to some place like, I don't know, Tasmania, for example.
Tasmania, all right.
Yeah, whatever. You know, some exotic place in the world, and you can't take that much gear with you. What is the bare minimum? Like, say you can take one bag, a big bag of gear, you know, one big camera bag. What would be in that bag to make sure that you... So you would feel comfortable, you'd come back with usable stuff?
I don't know. For me, it's hard because all my shoots, even my personal shoots, are like big productions. So it's hard to say like one bag. I would in my own bag, I guess I would just have a camera. But I'd bring an assistant with me to all the places who has another bag with a 7B pack in it.
Nice.
So they're the ones that has to haul it up the mountain.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, in a way it's relaxing because that means, like, I don't know, I always have this thing wherever I'm walking and I see something to take a photo of, I'm like, oh, damn, I don't have my camera. But at least by shooting this way, then I feel a little bit more relaxed because in order to do it the way that I'm happy with, I need the whole production, so.
yeah. So what is that whole production? So what's in a normal sort of, like, you know, not to go back to the Twilight thing, but any big shoot like that, what are we going to find on the set if we come visit you?
It depends totally on the shoot. Like, I don't like to determine how many lights they use to determine how it's going to look. So, you know, sometimes I can get it with one light. Sometimes it takes 10 lights. But on a big commercial shoot, you can expect a whole truck, truckload of stuff. But a Twilight shoot, we had two seamlesses going at the same time. So everything is done on seamless. And we had like a lighter setup on one seamless and a darker setup on the other. And I think each one had like maybe 10 lights each. So, and then just kind of like popping people back and forth between those two.
Very cool. So having worked with a big parade of celebrities so far, who's your favorite one to work with?
I don't know. I've been lucky because I haven't really got anybody who's been a terrible subject.
You got to give me the DVD extras answer. You know?
Oh, right.
Well, they always say everybody was so good to work with on this set. You know?
Right, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, no, and I hate being one of those guys. Trust me, I hate it as much as you hate to hear it. But I don't think I've ever had a problem. But
really,
I'd say the best. What's like? I really like rap music. Mm-hmm. And I probably like it for different reasons than just like being serious about hip hop. Yeah. But I did a shoot for G-Unit and I really like that because I don't know, I like 50 Cent.
Yeah. <That's
cool. laughs> but I don't know, it's maybe not for the same reasons why someone would worship 50 Cent, but I don't know, I just really find rap music, like that whole world, really interesting. So I enjoyed that shoot. Like, we rapped early and everything, but yeah, that was an interesting day.
And where did that take place? Where was that? New York?
Oh, that was in that was in a caviar restaurant in Manhattan.
Very cool. And what are those? What are those photos? Or can we see those photos now? Or are they?
Yeah. It was like about a year ago. I shot that for Vibe magazine.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. Just interesting. To have looked through the lens and see G-Unit sitting in the table in front of you.
That's awesome.
But I mean, it's also interesting to look through your lens and see an African tribe there too. It's just as shocking, I suppose.
yeah. So what's the interaction? Like, talk to me about the interaction between, like, sort of putting the African tribe at ease and being able to get a good shot and putting 50 Cent at ease and getting a good shot. Is there any similarities there? Well,
50 Cent's a piece of cake compared to the other ones. No, I mean, that's what I used to say when I didn't have many, I guess, like, celebrity clientele in my portfolio, because I was trying to get those jobs. So I was meeting a lot of people and they say, like, yeah, you know, but you don't have many celebrities in here. So how can you handle that shoot? I'm like, yo, buddy, this is a dude with a Kalashnikov. I'm like, posed for a photo.
Right.
So, you know, so I think I can handle it. But I think it's harder when I travel. So when I do the commercial shoots, it's like the most worst predicament I could ever find myself in is nothing compared to something that's happened to me on the road.
Yeah.
So in that case, I don't really get very nervous before shoots or anything like that, because I've seen it all.
Yeah. Well, I put a message out on Twitter telling folks that I was going to be talking to you and asked them to submit some questions.
And oh, wicked.
One just came in from William Beam. He wants to know if you agree with this article from CNN. He puts a link in there. I clicked on it, and it says...
Billy Beam.
Yeah, yeah, Billy Beam.
Like he hasn't heard that in his entire life.
Yeah, of course. Sorry. He's probably rolling his eyes right now.
He's probably like, yeah, well, Joey Lawrence from the 80s.
Exactly. Right. You brought it up. You brought it up, not me.
All right. What did Billy Beam has to say?
He says, he linked over to his article that says it's about stressful jobs that pay badly. And one of them is commercial photographer, and it says the median pay is $43,600. And the percent of those photographers that they surveyed that say their job is stressful is 100%. What do you say about that?
I think they surveyed a lot of broke college kids that don't know what they're doing with their lives.
statistics. Yeah, let's survey 100 people that are mad. Yeah.
No, I mean, like, I agree that it can be stressful, but it's like. It's my life. Like I can't really separate myself from myself as a photographer because like I don't really got nothing else. So yeah. It's like I don't have any days off because I don't have a job. I like it's my career. Like when I go meet for a portfolio meeting, I'm not trying to get a job. I'm trying to like sell myself. Do you know what I mean? So It's like everything I do is somehow connected to photography. So if life has a stressful moment. Then that's not because of my job. It's because of my life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. How do you you mentioned going in for a client meeting and that kind of stuff. So how do you get noticed? You know, when you're like, say you're just starting out and you don't have this impressive client list behind you.
Yeah.
And people aren't banging your door down. How do these $43,600 photographers get noticed?
Oh, well, I don't want to talk about their money, but. I was in the same boat not that long ago. Like I can't talk like I'm an old master. There's still things that I learn every day. But I've been doing pretty good for myself. So I think I think the most important thing is simply just like to get your work out there, because I know a lot of people that just do work and they just hide it. So you have to go around and show people. I mean, you can't just expect to take good photos and then something to happen. Like you got to hustle. Like 95% of my job is trying to get the stuff that I shot shown. So it's a constant struggle too. It's not like I'm at a safe point. Like no freelancer is ever at a point where they're like, oh yeah, I'm safe. You just have a bunch of get out of jail free cards in your portfolio of jobs that you've done. So there's no ever like, how did you get to the peak of where you are? Cause I could fall off that peak tomorrow. You know, like trends change, things change. So there's no ever any safety.
Well, how does social media fit into getting noticed and all that stuff? I mean, I know you're on Twitter and you got the blog going. How does all that work, and does it help you as a commercial photographer?
It does help. It helps me. Actually, a client that I did a shoot for followed my blog before he even hired me. But not only that, I think like Twitter is good for selling my tutorials and stuff like that, because a lot of people find out about it and it spreads so fast. But for clients, I got clients that first find my work interesting, and then if they want to know more, then they actually read my blog and they see my travel stuff, they see my written word. So then I guess they're more inclined to remember me because it's a little bit more personal. Mm-hmm. So I think the most, like the more barriers that you can break down and the more that you can just speak to people directly and more people, then of course that can only help you.
Yeah.
But you got to be professional too, because I can put out some really personal stuff on my blog too, but I don't really want to do that. So there's like a really thin line, but as many barriers as you can break down between people, it just helps people feel connected with your work. So it's all going to help in the end.
Yeah. And I was checking on your blog and looking through some of the work, and you were, I think you were saying somewhere that all of the images on your blog were processed by you. Now,
right.
So does that mean like all the images that you send out are yours? Like, for example, you know, you do the shoot in Africa or wherever, everything that you're going to send to the client, you touch personally, or do you have people that do that for you?
No, I try to do all my own retouching. There's some things that I didn't do, like Twilight I didn't do. But usually I'm not happy when it comes back.
Yeah.
If somebody else does it, which is fine. But I'm not against outsourcing my work because I get busy, and it's better to do two shoots and get paid for doing two shoots than it is to do one shoot and then get paid for the retouching of that same shoot. Okay. But so I'm not against outsourcing, but I'm like a really big control freak, so I prefer to do my own retouching. So I think 98% of the stuff on my website is my own retouch, especially my personal work. 100% of that is my own because I don't want anyone else touching that.
Sure, yeah. And what are you using to do your image management? And I'm sure you're using Photoshop to do the retouching and all that, but are you using Lightroom, Aperture, or what for the
Yeah, I use Capture One for raw conversion and to sort a few things. Mm-hmm. And I actually use this little program called Photo Mechanic a lot to build proof galleries and stuff. I build proof galleries right out of Photoshop, but when I'm like cutting down pictures, there's this little it's a really cheap program called Photo Mechanic, mm-hmm. and it's just like really bare bones, but it's a little bit better than using like the file browser on your computer. But no, I use that, and I'm lucky because I know a lot of photographers who shoot like weddings and they have to deliver like, you know, hundreds of images. But me, I just build a proof gallery from the shoot and I might have to edit like four. So I don't really have to spend a lot of time categorizing and organizing stuff yet.
Yeah. So when you're building that proof gallery and you've got the four selects that need the magic touch on them, I know this is probably job by job, but generally do you get to select the images that you're going to send on, or does the client look through the proofs and say, you know, 101, 105, and 213 are the ones that I want you to retouch?
Yeah, I'll build a proof gallery with only stuff that I'm happy with, mm-hmm. and then they choose from that gallery. So that way they're not going to pick something that I'm like, oh no, you picked that one, because usually they will pick that one.
You chose badly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very important on the shoot to make the image look as close to the end result as possible, because you know, you can't build a proof gallery and say like, yeah, well, I'm going to Photoshop this and later, because they don't share the same vision as you. So mm-hmm. you have to, you just have to build a really good proof gallery, even some like basic retouching, like batch curves on all of them or something, mm-hmm. is good. But yeah, build the proof gallery and make sure you're happy with all of them, because they'll probably pick the one that you're least happy with.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Pricing, you know.
Pricing.
Yeah. How do that's one of the biggest things that people that are entering any genre of photography have to deal with, whether they're going to become a wedding photographer, a portrait, models, yeah. commercial, whatever. How do you come up with, okay, this is how much my work is worth?
I work with my agents on that, because honestly, I'm not that, like, I've only learned from their example. But when I first started out, I used to do my all my own pricing. So it depends on a lot of things, like the usage, where it's going to be used, who the client is. You know, it's all case by case. So one day I could be making this much, and the next day I could be making, this much. So mm-hmm. What was it? Yeah, I don't know. I just think my biggest fear is that with the digital age, we have a lot of young people who are taking photographs, which is really good, because I think we'll see a lot of young, fresh talent. But my biggest fear is that those people aren't equally good with business. Because when you have a lot of amateurs starting out and a lot of young people, they don't know what to charge. So that can, in effect, hurt the industry, because you're up against somebody who's a really good photographer, but they're asking only this much, and they undercut themselves, but also you, and eventually the entire industry.
Yeah. Yeah, wedding photographers have been dealing with that for a while. You know, people.
Yeah, I think especially weddings right now, just because like it's hitting the commercial world as well, but weddings is just like, you know, regular people think like, oh, well, my friend Billy Joe has a camera, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Uncle Bob has just bought one of those new 7Ds. It looks like the same one you're going to be shooting my wedding with. Why do I need to pay you that much? Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not the best person to ask about prices, also because like I don't really want to share mine. but please, like if you don't know, then you should be working with someone who does know, because that'll help you out.
That's a good answer.
Don't ask me.
Well, you know, take it back to technique a little bit now. So you have a distinct style, and you know, of course you've mastered how to get the look that you're looking for in terms of of lighting. What advice would you give photographers in terms of how to develop their own personal style?
Well, I don't know, because then if I gave them advice, it wouldn't be their personal style.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Should they just look at your work and try to replicate it?
No, I think it's important to, it's really easy to look around the internet and taking this, taking that. And I think it's important to learn from all the people that you admire, your own photographers, just study what they're doing. But I think it's equally important to like take a break away from all that and just like go out and shoot. And eventually you'll find like what you like and what you don't like. And hopefully the stuff that you like is the stuff that you'll eventually be getting paid for, because that'll be your strongest, it'll be your strongest body of work. Yeah. If you just like shooting it, because then you'll be more inclined to get good at that particular look.
What about high definition? What is it? High dynamic range photography, HDR.
Right.
People that polarizes people. Either they love it or they hate it, or you know, nothing in between. Do you love it or hate it?
Well, I don't know, because like I'd done more of that kind of shit in the past, but I've seen some like really hideous stuff. But I've seen some also like nice subtle stuff where they just use that kind of technique to like bring a little detail back, and I actually prefer the subtle stuff. But I've seen some stuff where it looks like a chalk drawing, and it just like makes you want to throw up. So
yeah,
I don't know. Everything has its place. Like I can't really be one to judge it. Yeah. if they're doing good at it, then let them do it.
All right. Well, here's another polarizing thing: video, which is, of course, event photographers like weddings people and all that are sort of embracing it and adding it to their list of services that they offer. What about in the commercial photography world? Is it having any impact there? Are clients asking you to shoot video?
Yeah, man. It's becoming like they just shot. I think it was like a Maxim cover. No, it wasn't Maxim. I don't know. It was some kind of magazine cover that they just shot, where they had shot it with a red camera for the cover, and then they had an exclusive on their website of the video of the actual shoot, which I think is brilliant, because it, first of all, you make a new magazine cover, but then it pulls people to your website for all the viral traffic.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I've been asked a few times for jobs if you know how to use a 5D Mark II. Mm-hmm. And of course I've never used it, but I say, oh yeah, sure. because like I've shot like music videos and stuff. I've directed 5 music videos now, but I don't know. I think in the future we'll see more those kind of lines blurred, but I just hope people are billing for it as well.
Because
clients might expect, okay, in the future, well, this guy did the video and the photography for this price, so that means they all are going to do it. So I hope people that are going down that business route are being careful.
Yeah,
but embrace it for sure, because it's new technology and it's incredible. I saw the Vincent LaFerre video before it got taken down, the Nocturne. Like it's absolutely incredible. I mean that's Vincent LaFerre, so of course it's gonna look good, but it's incredible like what people can get their hands on these days.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Versus like shooting on like 35 or 16 millimeter in the past, as it can be, it's hell of expensive. So
yeah, tools are have come down to be in the reach of just normal people now. You know, so now
people
can push their vision if they have one. They don't have any excuses about, well, if I had that so and so gear.
That's right. Yeah, so I think we'll see a lot of new emerging talent and a lot of good stuff, and we'll also see a lot more crap.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so. Let's talk about your blog a little bit. So you've got a great commercial website, which I was going through, of course, and then your blog is your social media landing spot on the web. What how successful has that been? And is that driving a lot of traffic to your other side? And just take me through that.
I don't know. I made my blog for my mother because she was always worried about where I was. So my blog is whereisjoey.com or just like joeyl.com/blog, both take the same place.
Yep.
But I don't know. I made it for my mom because she was when I was traveling, especially with bands, she'd never know where I was. So on my website, I have the little live GPS map that she can go to. So I started out for that. But then all my old blog posts are kind of mindless crap. But all the recent ones, I've been getting more into writing, especially when I come back from a trip. Mm-hmm. So this, I just got back from Indonesia, and when I put that on my blog, I think it'll read more like a novel with photos. So that's kind of what I want to do, is have it my own platform to write what I want to write. And if people like it, then that's even better, because it helps me out too.
Very cool. All right, tell me about Sessions with Joey L.
Sessions with Joey L.
Yeah.
Well, it's the best thing ever, so you should buy it.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're a better marketer than that. Come on.
it's pretty much the magic thing that will make you a better photographer instantly. You don't even have to watch it. You just buy it and it'll make you better.
Mix a little water with it, drink it, and you'll be Joey L.
Yeah. I just add water. No, it's a tutorial package that I put together because I get asked to do a lot of workshops, which I'm really flattered about. A lot of people always ask me to come do a workshop. But the problem is I can never commit to them because I'm always doing commercial jobs, which could come up a week in advance or even a couple of days in advance. So it's very hard for me to commit to workshops because workshop people have their stuff together, because they ask me, can you do this workshop in 8 months from now? And I never know what's going to happen 8 months from now. Yeah. So I always have to say no to workshops. And then I got thinking, well, if a lot of people want to learn from me, then I'll just record a workshop myself. So it's the answer to that. It's anybody who wants to learn from me about lighting, about business, about Photoshop, and about even travel, then that's kind of the package dedicated to them.
Very cool. And when did that go live?
It's only, I think October 10th, October 12th.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's really new. And, 4 hours of content. My friend Kale, Glending came up from California, and it's all the video footage is really, really slick. Helped me out on it. And it's just basically a mind dump of everything that I know.
Okay. So that sounds like a really good program. What's the bottom line? What's it going to cost me to get that DVD? What's the catch? How much does it cost?
All your money. All your money. Put it in my pocket. No, it's $299. There's a discount for people who buy the old disc. Price is just the price of knowledge. So for those people who feel that knowledge is important to them, then it will be a good bargain for them. And for people who feel it is not, then there are different tutorials for them, and that's fine. But yeah, knowledge is power, and knowledge is expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's sort of if someone that has made it and they're willing to share how they made it and condense it down into a disc form to tell you, hey, do this, and this is how I did it, then, yeah, it's almost, you can't really put a price on that.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, there's other good tutorials, too, that aren't just mine. I'm not against referencing them. The David Hobby Strobus set is really good, and it's a little bit cheaper than mine. And there's Scott Kelby Training, which is cheaper than mine as well. But still, they're both very, very different. So go to the store page if you're interested. Read exactly what I have to offer. And if you think that it's going to help you, it's going to help your business, and it's a good investment, then go for it, and I'll be very happy.
This has been awesome, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me and being so open about things and run through it. I think the This Week in Photography audience is going to get a lot of this interview.
All right, cool, man. Well, no worries.
So, if people want to find out more about you and follow you online, where should they go?
They should, well, my website is joeyl.com. My Twitter is joeyl.com. Like, but for Twitter, it's different. It's joeyl.com. There's no dot.
Yep.
And blog is wheresjoey.com. Tutorials is learnfromjoey.com. So I got the whole branding down. So it's all something to do with Joey. Yeah, learn from Joey.
Learn from Joey. Well, the main thing to remember is joeyl.com.
Joeyl, because there's my real name's Joey Lawrence, and there's that other guy from the 80s, and I always get made fun of. So.
I bet you do.
I'm the real Joey Lawrence.
Cool. Thanks again, and yeah, we'll keep an eye out for you online.
All right, thank you.
All right, that was photographer Joeyl. You can find out more and check out his work at joeyl.com. Really impressive guy, and definitely just browse through his site because his stuff is very, very firmly planted into the amazing side of things. All right, now we're going to jump into some listener questions. We've got the first question, Steve, is assigned to you. Take it away.
Okay. Hi, my name is Mansoor, and I am from Iran. I hate lens caps, and therefore I slap a B&W UV filter on my lenses. Since I take my gear to rough places, some of my filters have scratches. However, on the pictures, I can't see them. Do scratch filters decrease my lens image quality? Thank you very much for your help. Well, that's a question that everyone has a different opinion on. I mean, obviously, not introducing another piece of glass between your actual lens, which hopefully will be of high quality, is probably the best way to get maximum quality out of it. Personally, though, for years, I have kept a filter on my lens to protect it, a UV filter, and it has. There have been times when I've dropped it and the filter has shattered, but the lens was perfectly fine. I definitely keep a lens hood on my lenses to prevent stray light from causing flare and reducing overall contrast. But the idea of a high quality filter over your lens, personally, I have not seen any difference. And when I finally decided to take the filters off my lenses, and really kind of pixel peep and look at the difference, I personally couldn't really find it. And I eventually decided that, you know what, I'm just going to put a high quality filter on my lens. And I'm a professional and these things are tools I know, and I probably shouldn't, but I just didn't see any difference. So for the most part, I wanted to protect the lens. There are times when I might take it off in an environment that is relatively safe too. Just to maximize everything. I know, Fred, we've had this conversation. I saw you recently, and I know you have no filters on your lenses, and I totally respect that. But just like my grandmother, you know, she finally took the plastic off the couches a few years ago. I did the same thing, and I honestly didn't notice a difference, so I decided I'll just protect these lenses. They'll last longer, et cetera. So, and the other thing, and Ron mentioned, I'll let him talk to it quickly. If you stop down the lens, and, you know, when I was in Edmonton, Bruce, I worked for the Edmonton Journal, and we had a 300-2.8 that had, you know, it was scratched. But when you're shooting wide open, I tell you what, you could not see the difference. You could not, you would never guess the degree of damage that was done to that front element. It worked absolutely fine. Certainly, if you stop down to F1116, you're going to see more of it. But
yeah, that's exactly the point I wanted to make. Is that it's really, really dependent. I mean, this specific question that Mansoor asked is, you know, he's got scratches on some of his filters, but he doesn't see it when he's shooting, and that is extremely dependent on the aperture you're shooting at. When you're shooting wide open, you're getting light coming in at a variety of angles that sort of pass through that aperture, and it tends to mitigate any sort of damage on the front of the lens. And you can literally, I mean, this is dramatic, the difference you can see. You can take a really wide lens, like a, you know, 50mm f1.4, and you can hold a pencil up to the, you know, right in front of the lens, like right across the entire lens, and take a photo. And if you're shooting wide open, you may not see any change to the image, or especially not something that's particularly noticeable unless you're doing it side by side. You mostly just get light loss. But if you stop down to, you know, f22, that's going to be a big, huge, you know, you'll see the pencil. It's going to be a big, huge bar across the lens. It's really pretty amazing how much you can get away with when you're shooting wide open in terms of problems on the front of the lens, dust and scratches and all of that. So, you know, if you've got a scratch filter, you just have to be aware that that's one of the things that you're dealing with is as you stop down, you're going to see more of it. And also, focusing closer versus far away will have a little bit of an effect on that, too. The other thing I would say about lenses or lens filters and glass in front of it, and I've said this before, is that in ideal situations, yes, Steve's right, you're not going to see anything. The place that it really becomes problematic is if you've got some kind of light hitting the front of the lens element. So Steve shoots with a lens hood on, that's going to take care of most of that. But if you're shooting without a hood and have a filter on there and you're catching some real side light hitting it, you know, you're going to start to flare out, and that's where it becomes problematic.
Yeah. Bruce, are you in the camp of having a lens filter on your camera, or do you go bareback?
I go back and forth on that. I started putting filters on a lot of my lenses, and then I ran across an interesting blog post somewhere. I can't remember now where I saw it, and it was an image that they shot of they had a 70-200 lens that they dropped, and it was the front element was completely smashed, and they continued to shoot with it, and you couldn't see, you know, any evidence of it. Like Ron was saying, you're shooting wide open, you couldn't see any evidence of it. And so I started to think, well, what's a minor little scratch going to do if this, you know, whole front element is smashed and you don't see any effect? So I've tended to take a lot of the filters that I had off, and I pretty much just go with a lens hood on most of mine. And I find that gives, you know, sufficient protection generally for what I'm doing. I kind of baby my lenses. So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm the same way. And, you know, Steve, I know you and I have almost come to blows over this issue, but my mindset comes from a photographer whom I know and admire, Seth Resnick, sitting in on one of his D65 workshops, and what he basically says in a nutshell is when you put, basically saying that these cameras are tools that are finely tuned to give, you know, finely tuned optics versus electronics, and all this stuff is put together specifically to render the best image possible on the sensor in the camera. And when you throw a, I don't know, $50, $60, $100, $200 filter or whatever on the front of your multi-$1,000 camera, you're kind of defeating the purpose, you know, which is, Steve, like your grandma's house of, you know, having plastic on her $7,000 couch, you know.
Yeah, but I don't buy that as a rational argument. I mean, part of the reason why you put a filter on the front of your camera is to protect it, right? It's not about the image quality. And the point is, if you're in a situation where you need to protect it, it's a valid thing to do, and you may not see the difference. I mean, I encourage everybody to go.
It's a toss-up, though. It's a toss-up.
You know, guys,
quality versus
going,
photography.
But my point is, there is not going to be a quality difference in most lighting situations. I can guarantee you this, that, you know, you're not going to do the test. Shoot it yourself and see what kind of a difference you can see with a high-quality filter in a good lighting condition.
All right, Joseph did that test, Ron. Joseph Linaski, who we had co-hosting last week, he did that test and posted the results to his blog at traveljunkie.com.
I've seen many tests of this, and it's very dependent on the lighting situation. If you've got a control. You disagree that it's dependent on the lighting conditions or not?
It wasn't me and you that almost came to blows. I think it was Ron and you that almost came to blows.
Yeah, I know. I'm coming down there, Ron, after the show.
You know, if you're going to the beach, you know, obviously if you don't normally have a filter on, if you have a high-quality filter, it would certainly make sense in that situation to introduce a filter on there. If you're shooting in very low light, and I saw the Joseph test, and, you know, if you've got sort of specular highlights or light sources in the image,
exactly.
Why not, you know, take the filter off for those situations? It's relatively safe. And the other thing, too, is a lot of these lenses, my understanding is the front element itself, yeah, sure, it's expensive to replace, more than a filter would cost, but it's not the most expensive part, especially the big glass. So it may cost $200 or $300 to replace that front element on your lens. But over the course of years, I mean, you're spending money on filters anyway. So, I mean, you know, really, it depends on you. There's no, yeah.
That's why I tend to get, you know, a little bit aggro about some of this is I just hate anybody that makes these blanket statements about you should do this or you shouldn't do that, when almost everything in photography is balancing off a lot of trade-offs, and there are times where it makes sense to do one. And as long as you understand, you know, everything that's going on in your optics path, you can make those decisions.
Yeah. All right. Well, I would encourage folks to just do your own research and check out Joseph's blog for his review. And like Ron says, it's entirely dependent on the lighting situation. His blog is confessionsofatraveljunkie.com. So check it out and just do a search for, I don't know, lens filter test or something. You should be able to find it. All right. Next question is assigned to me. It's from Warren Verity. And he asks, he says he has the Canon PowerShot G9, and he wants to know if he'll get value out of the wide and teleconverters that are available. He's wondering if they offer greater abilities or distance and close-up for distant shots and close-ups. And he says he recently read a blog that said they offer no more than the camera already gives. I'll say, and he says, thanks, love the show. I'll say that my experience is I have no experience with those on this particular camera body. For some old video cameras, digital video cameras that I've owned, some Sony cameras, I've bought the lens attachments to go wide angle with them, and they work. I mean, you know, you're converting it to wide angle. But if you need that, I mean, it depends on what you're trying to shoot. I mean, if you're going and you're trying to do landscapes and stuff with your G9, then yeah, definitely a teleconverter or a wide angle converter will give you a wider view. I mean, just go get one or go in the camera store would be my suggestion. Take your camera, go in a camera store, and play around with them and see what they do before you plunk down the money, because those things are pretty expensive. But of course, like anything you put in front of your lens, like we were talking about with the last question, you're going to potentially degrade the quality of that of your image by, you know, a factor when you interrupt that light beam that's coming into your camera. What do you guys think? Have you had any experience with putting these converters on the front of your cameras?
Mm. Well, I just remember that the old Spiritone in the back of the ads, they used to have that 45-degree angle thing where it looked like you're aiming one way and, in essence, you're taking shots 45 degrees where you're not looking. So it's really good for kind of voyeuristic and, you know, creepy-type photography. But, I mean... But the quality that you get with that obviously was nowhere near the raw lens. There's no question. I think when you start to look at converters for cameras like the G9, I think you're really, you know, should be looking at maybe getting a bigger camera like a DSLR, because I think you'll probably end up with a lot more possibility and better quality in a similar kind of size. So. That would be my recommendation. But, you know, what the heck? I mean, if it's small, it's inexpensive, it's certainly worth playing with, I guess, if you
yeah,
have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the statement that offering no more than the camera already gives, because obviously they are going to change your capabilities. I mean, you will be able to go wider than your existing wide-angle lens and longer with your existing, you know, zoom amount if you buy one of these converters. So they certainly, you know, they're not a complete scam. It's just that, again, there's trade-offs on it.
Sure. Yeah. Just like everything. All right, Ron, go ahead, Bruce. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say I have a 1X teleconverter that I use. But actually now that I shoot with a 5D Mark II, Ron will like this. Sometimes if I want a little extra length, I'll just switch to my 40D and take advantage of that crop sensor to get a little extra length and do it that way. Obviously, that's a little more expensive route to go. But... Yeah. Sometimes I do that. And I don't know what it's like down in the States. Up in Canada, we have very limited rental options available to us. I don't know if something like that would be something that the lens rental places in the U.S. would rent out. I know it's very difficult in Canada. So we're lucky to get a decent selection of lenses to begin with. So,
yeah, I'm not sure about that. I would encourage folks to check out services like lensrentals.com and see what they have to offer. And... you know, shipping internationally, you know, it may be worth it to just go buy it as well. So who knows? So, Ron, the next question is assigned to you. Take it away.
Sure. This is from listener Dan Fenn. He says, I shoot virtually 100% in RAW. With this in mind, is there any advantage to shooting in the various basic modes offered on the 50D? Seems to me the only real advantage, if you could call it that, is the aperture and shutter speed would be set automatic in the basic modes. Is this correct? Also, what about the ability to select different picture styles, standard, portrait, landscape? If I shoot in RAW, will the settings, you know, the sharpness and the contrast and all of those things in a selected picture style have any effect on the image I capture? It's a good question, and I think a lot of the websites that do reviews of cameras don't even make this very clear, that most of those settings don't have a whole lot to do if you're shooting in RAW in terms of the picture style stuff. These are things that are going to get baked into the JPEG when you shoot, But if you're shooting raw, you can kind of ignore all of that, and they're not going to do anything. They will affect what you're seeing in your viewfinder typically, though. So if you dial in a certain picture style, but then you shoot raw, in some ways I think you're kind of fooling yourself into what you're going to get. Sometimes, I know some of these post-production tools like Aperture and Lightroom will take the information from the picture style and try to apply something similar, but it's not a hardwired thing. If you're really working in a good raw workflow, you can dial those back down and do it. So, and as far as the other, the basic modes on Canon, which is, you know, sort of the more automated, you know, set it to high-speed photography or portrait photography, all of that. Yeah, those are kind of, I never use any of those when I shoot, just because I want the control. And they're really, that was not so much a matter of whether you're shooting raw or not. That's just taking a little bit of the control away from you.
Excellent. All right, we've got Bruce.
Can I just add to that?
No, you can't, Steve. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
I was just going to add that, you know, picture control in Nikon has similar things. And as Ron mentioned, with Capture NX2, you could emulate those looks that you would set to your JPEGs on the back of the camera, which can really speed things up in post-processing. And I'm curious with Bruce, because I know there are some high-end wedding photographers, because they shoot such a volume of imagery, they become really, really good and confident in shooting JPEGs. So they'll actually do their own little custom control picture settings, you know, setting the color they like, set a specific kind of black and white JPEG setting, and it gets baked in. But I tell you what, it looks fantastic because their exposure's right on and so on. And it ends up saving them not only space from shooting RAW, but also time in terms of having to post-process and create images that you need. So I too, never really saw the great value in that because RAW is just so much, there's so much more you can do, and you can do, and you have the backup in case things go wrong. But I do know that high-volume shooters, it might make sense to get to know them really well so that you can save a lot of time down the road.
Excellent. Now, Bruce, are you shooting JPEG or RAW?
I shoot RAW all the time.
Okay. Now, did you switch to RAW, or have you always been shooting RAW?
Pretty much always been shooting RAW from the very beginning.
Excellent.
But then I use Lightroom for my workflow, so.
Very cool. All right, let's jump into the picks of the week. And since Bruce is joining us brand new today, let's give him the honor of going first. Bruce, what's your pick of the week?
So I had a couple picks this week, and I couldn't decide which one to go with. And I decided to select this particular cause. It's called Help Portrait. I don't know if you guys have heard of this movement, but basically the idea behind it is to use your photography to sort of give back, particularly right now around the holidays. And the idea behind it is it's trying to organize photographers and others, you know, maybe makeup artists, hairstylists, you know, anybody that wants to donate their time and or resources or a location. And the idea behind it is to do portrait photography for people who might not necessarily be able to afford proper portrait photography. And the whole event itself is taking place on December 12th, 2009, sort of all around the world. So there's different, and it's sort of, again, it's a grassroots type of thing. So every city and town are doing their own, organizing their own events and doing their own thing. So you can definitely check it out. The website is at help-portrait.com, and sort of all the details are there. And then you can search for your particular city and sign up there and see what, you know, what other photographers are doing in that area. And it's sort of a chance to give back to those, you know, maybe who just can't afford to have, you know, a family portrait taken.
Yeah, definitely. It's an excellent cause. I had the opportunity to chat with Jeremy Coward. He's the guy behind Help Portrait, and he's a great guy. Heart is in exactly the right spot about this particular initiative. So definitely check out the site. And I'm going to interview him, I think, and we may try to bring him on live on the show if we can work the logistics. But definitely he's going to be on TWIP before this thing kicks off, talking about Help Portrait. So excellent tip, Bruce. Thanks. Ron, what's your tip?
Yeah, I think it was a couple of months back I mentioned an iPhone app called Helios that was a pretty cool app for kind of figuring out where the sun is, and most specifically where it's going to rise in the morning if you're setting up and want to get a good sunrise shot. The problem with Helios is it was like a $30 app, which is kind of ridiculously priced these days for iPhone apps. So there's a new one out there called Sunseeker, and this one is only $299, and it's actually very cool. It gives you the plot of sort of, you know, uses the, if you've got the newest iPhone, and uses the compass to point to you where the sun is going to rise. It's got some nice graphics on it. And it also even has sort of an overlay mode where you can hold up your camera and see this sort of virtual reality or augmented reality overlay of where the sun is in the sky, which you might think is sort of pointless since you can usually look up and see it. But on really cloudy days where you can't quite identify exactly where the sun is, it can be kind of useful if you're setting something up and you know the sun is going to kind of come in and out behind clouds. Just knowing exactly where the sun is kind of fun. So it's called Sunseeker, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Excellent. Cool. And Steve Simon, what's your pick this week?
Well, my pick this week is a book that I recently got. It's called Periodical Photographs by Dan Winters. And he's an editorial photographer based in Austin, Texas. And chances are you've seen his work because his work has been published in just about every major place that great photography is published, primarily portraiture. But just I've long admired his work, and this I think is his first book where he's assembled kind of a retrospective up till now of some of the images that he chose to put in this this book that he created, published by Aperture. And I think he used to shoot a lot of large format film. I'm not sure exactly where he's at digitally. I assume he's probably shooting digitally, but the images here, although they are very different, there's a definite sensibility to his style and his lighting. It's just beautiful. And I think for any student of photography that likes to photograph people, it's a great book to look at and learn from. You know, I've heard him speak, I think online, not personally, but he talked about, you know, when you see sort of developing your style in photography, and often in portrait photography, you can look at like Avedon and very technically based in terms of, you know, white background, always. Platon uses like a wide-angle lens a lot. But there's a real diversity in Dan Winter's portrait stuff, yet there's a sensibility, I think, that he talks about in terms of his style that gives him sort of a unique vision and look. And I think in looking through this book, there's a lot to be gleaned and learned from. So that's why I made it my pick of the week. Periodical Photographs by Dan Winters.
Excellent. Great picks this week, guys. All right. My pick of the week is, I'm going to say it's Geek Brief TV. If you haven't heard of Geek Brief TV, and then you're probably under a rock somewhere. But it's a show put on by Callie Lewis. You can follow her at Callie Lewis on Twitter. And specifically, I mean, the show is great because they talk about all kinds of geek-related things, including new cameras and phones and all that kind of thing. So it is related to photography. But I had the opportunity to hang out with Callie and her husband Neil over the last, actually 2 days last week, working on a project. And Callie was just about to review, or had already reviewed, the Motorola Droid, which is this guy right here, this camera that I'm holding up, or this phone that I'm holding up, the Motorola Droid. It's an awesome little device. So the Geek Brief TV podcast / show and the Motorola Droid are both my picks of the week. If you want to learn more about this particular device and how it stacks up to this device, I'm holding up the iPhone for you people on audio, head over to geekbrieftv.com and just do a search for the Droid, and you'll see. My first impressions of this thing are, I'm a little jealous. It has a bunch of features that my phone, or my iPhone doesn't have, like a 5-megapixel camera with a LED light on it to light things up. It's got a physical keyboard on there, which I don't really care about, but it's kind of nice to have it there. But a cool thing on the keyboard is, and I'm holding this up for the people on audio, this little thing right here, and it's a little biometric sensor
so that you can unlock your phone. So you can just basically, it'll recognize your thumbprint and unlock itself. So if you happen to lose your phone, unless you've lost your thumb as well, no one's not going to have access to your data. So it's a pretty cool device. Definitely interesting and worth looking at. I don't think it's going to make me in particular switch away from the iPhone. This one happens to belong to Colleen, who works here at the Twit Cottage, and I was telling her that I probably wouldn't switch away from iPhone specifically because of the apps and the photography apps that are available for iPhone. But who knows? You know, maybe those will start showing up for Droid as well. Anyway, that is my pick of the week. And that brings us to a close of This Week in Photography. Guys, Bruce, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. I'm just at Bruce Clark on Twitter, and that's Clark with an E, so it's Bruce, C-L-A-R-K-E. Or they can head on over to my website, which is momentsindigital.com, or momentsindigital.com/blog is my blog.
Excellent. And Mr. Ron Brinkman, as if people don't know, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Ron Brinkman, R-O-N-B-R-I-N-K-M-A-N.
All right. Steve Simon, where do you hang out online?
Twitter/Steve Simon. And I'm going to be doing a couple of workshops in February, one in New Orleans with Nikon and the Mentor Series, mentorseries.com. And at Macworld, February 11th, I'll be giving a day-long workshop. You guys going to be at Macworld this year?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll be there.
Nope.
Ron, have you had your coffee today? What's the matter with you?
Somebody wants to pay for my trip to Macworld, I'll go.
Oh, yeah. Hey, this may be the last Macworld. Who knows? You know, you should go.
Well, who knows? Never say never.
Never say never. Bruce, are you going to Macworld?
No, I'm saving my pennies. I'm actually going to Italy in the spring with Kevin Kubota for a week. So I'm actually saving my bucks for that trip.
Wow. Wait, I assume this is a work trip and not a romantic trip?
Yes, I should qualify that. Yes, this is. I'm bringing my wife along.
I'm trying to help you here, man. I'm trying to help you. All right, cool. For me, you can find me online at twitter.com/FrederickVan. That's F-R-E-D-E-R-I-C-K, Van, or on my blog at frederickvan.com. And also, doing a workshop, a Smug Mug This Week in Photography workshop. Actually, it's a free workshop, so you can afford to come to this thing if you're in the Bay Area. You can find out the details for that at twip.eventbrite.com. And basically, it's going to be a two-model shoot in which everyone who attends this workshop will get a chance to shoot these models. And the models will have signed model releases, so you'll be able to walk away and show your images wherever you want and all that good stuff. And lots of training and just fun. It'll be a great time. So check it out at twip.eventbrite.com. And sign up, RSVP, get your free ticket. We're limiting it to 100 people, so you might want to sign up now if you're planning on coming. And that's the end of our show. It's I think it's about time to take that lens cap off.